Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
All right, everybody, welcome back to this episode. I am excited, like I say at the beginning of all my episodes, about my next guest that I have on the show with me today. I am speaking with Dr. Tana Session, and she is an award-winning international speaker, best-selling author, and she's a certified executive-level performance strategist. And her life journey is actually pretty much in alignment with the theme of One Broken Mom here, which it means it includes her starting this life being born into the New York City foster care system and spending the first 3.5 years of her life actually there until she became reunited with her biological family. She has overcome all of those adversities and probably more, and we can touch on any of them that she wants to share with us, but she is a powerhouse and hugely successful. She's a respected leader in the field of organizational and corporate consulting. And I found her through LinkedIn because she's got courses on there. And she, and because I also work with businesses and through human resources, she's in there, and people come to her for a lot of things. Her core practice is in inclusion and diversity and in the workplace. And when we talk about that, we have to start to talk about the concept of unconscious or implicit biases, which we all possess. And no matter how informed or open-minded, we all think that we are. And so I wanted Tina to be able to come on here and to talk to us about this because, of course, we like to think that we're all just wonderful human beings and we're all here for growth, but we do have these things that actually get in our heads and they actually inform our decisions. And so this is one of those conversations where we're going to break that down and find out what that means and how to recognize it and maybe what we can do about it when we sense it and what we do about it in our personal lives as well as our professional lives. So welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here.
Well, that is amazing. Thank you for saying that. I know this is going to sound weird and maybe a bit meta to start off this way, but I feel like when people deny that the biases impact their decisions, that they're always using, that we're always logical and rational human beings, that in some way is actually also a form of a bias, denying bias. Is that true or not?
Yes. It absolutely is. You know, I usually ask people when I do trainings on this, I say, raise your hand if you woke up with bad intentions today, and hopefully no one's hand goes up, right? Because that's not generally how we move through life as human beings. We don't want to say things or do things for the most part that are insensitive or inappropriate, but because of how our brain works, sometimes we fall prey to that. So we're all guilty, as you said from the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've described the brain to other people. It's like, you know, the brain is amazingly complex and stupidly simple. Like it's both of those things, right? Like when you think of the computing power of the human brain and its abilities, it's like, whoa, just mind blowing, right? And we don't even know all of it really. But at the same time, biases are like the shortcuts that the brain also uses, which just oversimplifies life and gets us into trouble all the time, whether we want it or not. Right. And we have to know that both of those things exist, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when we talk about denying a bias, let's do the definitions. Let's start there. Like what is a unconscious or an implicit bias, and how is that different from explicit bias?
Yeah. So unconscious bias is when we make these spontaneous judgments, and these could be based off of our past experience, the perspective of others, our belief system, the way we were raised, even our exposure to media, and that could be social media these days. And as a result, our brain stores these little mini bits of information, and it relies on those little mini bits to help us make decisions. And then when we make those decisions based on stereotypes or attitudes, that's the implicit bias. So sometimes people will use implicit and unconscious bias synonymously, but I'd like to tell my people when I'm training is that they're actually two heads of the same coin because they need each other and they support and thrive off of each other. So that's the definition of those two. And then explicit bias is when you know exactly what you're doing and it's very intentional, right? So you may be drawn on past experience or the perspective of others, but you're very intentional about why you're making that decision.
Right. So that might be like a belief system that we have about, like, say, women and gender, which is something that I'm very sensitive to, right? Like, women can't do this or men can only do that. Like, that's the explicit bias, the belief system in there somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So what would be an example then of an implicit bias or an unconscious bias?
One of those would be, so an implicit bias, one of those could be, again, based on a stereotype, is that you are walking down the street, you're doing your morning walk, and you happen to see, let's say you're a female, and you happen to see a man walking towards you with a hoodie, and let's say this man is a person of color, and you immediately think, I need to cross the street, or I should wait until he passed and continue, or I need to look over my shoulder and make sure he's not following me. Or you're in an elevator and a man gets in and you're a woman and you have a purse on your shoulder and you hug your purse a little tighter because you feel like something might happen. He might want to grab my purse. That's based on stereotype, especially when we're talking about men of color. So that would definitely be implicit bias. And then if you think about a spontaneous judgment, that again could be driven off of that bias, off of that stereotype or attitude. But when you think about those spontaneous judgments, you know, one example I use is, you know, a man saying to a woman on the team, well, I didn't invite you to the golf outing this weekend because I didn't think women like playing golf. That would be an example of that.
Yeah. And, you know, when you gave some of those examples, you know, a couple of things that cropped up into my head thinking about them was, you know, sometimes it seems like a bias is an assumption that we've gotten because of the way life has played out in front of us. You know, whether we, like you said, media, things that we've heard our families talk about, things that we've heard in our communities as we grew up. And, you know, without any evidence of anything different from that, it just becomes a part of, you know, this internal culture that we have. And then there is, I think of the bias of like, it's a flashback, a memory of trauma, you know, of an experience of like maybe being a woman who was attacked in an elevator and like you carry that memory of that feeling, you know, of that sense. Sure. Are those two different kinds of things? I mean, one is a bias and one's actually just a re-triggering event or a trauma event?
So I get that question a lot. And you're right. There's opportunities where our brain has to work off of fight, flight, freeze, or collapse. And that's built into our DNA, built into our brain to protect us from danger. So when we have a traumatic event that is, you know, that we have memories of and something draws or triggers that memory, such as maybe you got robbed before, maybe you were attacked on the street before. And as a result of that, now when you see someone who resembles that person, you automatically react, right? Your body is going to send those sensors, your brain, you're going to tense up, you're going to get nervous. You probably will have an elevated heart rate, maybe break out in a sweat, become fearful or freeze where you can't even move. So yes, there's two different instances. And then again, that's based off of real danger based off of your own personal experience versus I'm basing this off of what I've seen on the media, what I've seen on TV, the latest news story. Again, like you said, what someone shared with me was their experience. Well, that wasn't your experience. It's never happened to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are some of the most common biases that we have, you know, I mean, I know that there's like hundreds of them, right? Like, and I think that they keep coming up with different names. Like I saw one time it was like, there was like 190 and then that number went up to 215 and I'm like, holy crap, we got too many scripts in our heads.
We absolutely do, unfortunately.
Yeah. And some of them seem obvious, like right, gender bias, like that's one I talk about, racial bias. But I mean, there are some other ones that when I've looked through the list, I'm like, huh, that's really kind of funny. But yet, you know, I can see where, you know, people do have a bias. So what were the ones that you run into often, especially in workplace and personal?
Yeah, I would say top of mind would be similarity bias. And that's where you relate, you prefer someone who you have something similar with, whether it's your background, your education, their experience in the workplace, or maybe you worked at the same company. And that even ties into affinity bias. So affinity bias is, you know, you did go to the same college or you played the same sports. And so you feel like, oh, there's something that we have in common here. So I'm going to give them the upper hand in this interview process because I can relate to them or something's familiar to me in regards to, you know, their background or what they've shared with me in regards to their educational experience. And then another one that people don't really pay attention to is beauty bias. So oftentimes, again, in the workplace, if you think about if you're in an interview or you're interviewing someone, there's a beauty bias that kicks in that we may or may not be familiar with. So if we see someone that doesn't necessarily fit our mode of what we think is beauty, whether that's by body size, physical appearance, you know, color hair, color of eyes, we will actually not rate them mentally as highly as we would someone else because that beauty bias kicks in.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you say that, and of course I can hear all the objections from everybody that that never happens and that they would never do that. So how would somebody actually know if they are, if that bias has kind of taken root into the decision-making process? Cause you know, the secret here is that these are unconscious. So how do we know when we're unconsciously doing something, right?
Yeah. So there's a couple of strategies that tell people. One is to double check yourself, right? If you're making an immediate assumption or an immediate decision about someone who you've never met before, then you need to think about why is that, right? So what is there that you're drawn on in terms of something familiar to you, whether it's real or based on a bad past experience or something you saw in the media, you know, what is it that's really driving that initial reaction? Because you don't really know them, right? And you don't have enough information to make a full picture of who they are as an individual. You're basing it purely on their physical appearance or maybe the way they speak or the clothes that they have on. So you have to give yourself that self-awareness gut check. And then I know sometimes people will say, it's my gut, right? And they'll say, oh, it's my gut, or I have a sixth sense. That's a bias. So we have to really think about what's really driving those decisions for us. And then another strategy is to bring someone else into the conversation who has a different perspective, because that can help broaden our own lens into why we're making that first judgment or that first assumption about that particular person that we are just meeting for the first time or just getting to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think of so many other parallels besides work, but obviously in like our personal life, you know, that we do this pretty routinely. And in fact, like, as I was sitting here thinking about this, it's like, we use biases in deciding really our friendships and our relationships, and in it, it's second nature, right? I mean, it's like almost a de facto. I mean, I can't think of us, you know, dating sites come up. Like, dating sites are all built on bias, aren't they? Right. And so I can imagine that when we use biases, you know, I want to say it positively, you know, like choosing to create communities around us, maybe, and maybe it's not positive if the bias or assumption is negatively oriented, right? Or really excluded on false information and stuff. Like, that's kind of the downside to it. But I could hear somebody and even myself of like, well, you know, I do have things I do like. I do like hanging out with people that are similar to me. And if it's so second nature to us in our personal lives, I can totally see why then when you switch over to work, you don't even know it's actually happening. But yet it's not a good thing for it to happen at work. And I know that sounds like a no-brainer, but because that's how we exclude people, right?
That's right. Yep. And I read a study where they said 90% of the people who we engage with or interact with are people who look like us, right? So we look for people that are similar to your point in some way, shape, or form. That is, it makes it easier, right? It makes it easier to have a conversation. There's something relatable there. It makes, for the most part, the relationship somewhat effortless. You know, of course, there'll be some bumps along the road, but you have a pretty familiar foundation to start with. And so the same thing applies in the workplace. When we are interviewing, when we're thinking about who should join our team, when we're thinking about who's going to be our work buddy and who we hang out with, there is a level of bias there. And so that's why sometimes I know we're not in the workplace now, but when you go into the workplace and let's say they have a cafeteria, and you'll see this even in schools, you'll see people who look the same tend to sit together, right? You may see a couple little outliers here and there, but for the most part, it's almost like communal to just automatically gravitate towards those who look like you. So you have to be intentional and not only diversifying in the workplace, but even your own personal network, because that helps with expanding your perspective on people, places, or situations that you aren't familiar with, because they'll be able to bring that diversification into your immediate social network, which would then also help in the workplace.
Right, right. Now, do you know anything about, like, is there some sort of biological origin of something like that? I mean, honestly, like, I'm just wondering, like, I always scratch my head and I wonder about it because, you know, if that sounds like this thing that we all tend to do, unless we take an intentional step to not do it, right? So then I always go back and like, well, what's the biology behind why we would have a bias like that? Is that a social bias or is there some sort of like origin? And I don't know if you know that. I mean, you've got the doctor.
I don't know that for sure, but I do think it's partly social, but I think also it's just, for lack of a better analogy, it's almost like our instinct, right? To do that as human beings, just like animals kind of attract to each other and they run in herds and pods. We somewhat do the same thing. So we are, as human beings, I think, naturally drawn to what's familiar to us. You know, when we interact and we are communal people, if you think about how we've been separated for the last year, and now it's like people couldn't wait to get out of the house. They couldn't wait to take off their mask and start socializing again because we have to have that socialization. We're social creatures. And I think the first thing that we do is to look for things that are familiar in others so that we feel not only drawn to them, but we feel comfortable there.
Right, right. Psychological safety, right? Yes. In the familiarity. And the other thing that the brain does is it oversimplifies what familiarity is. And sometimes it's not good for us. Like that was the other thing. And we talk a lot about that on my show here of like understanding that we may have done it in the past. It doesn't mean it was good for us. It was just familiar for us, right?
Relationships, exactly.
yeah, totally. Now I have to ask, how did you get into this field? I mean, it's fascinating in the work that you do. And so I don't want to jump over this, you know, amazing history that, you know, you've got behind you, but, you know, how did you get to this place in, you know, in your career to be like studying this kind of stuff and helping people out with this kind of thing?
Yeah, I was doing another interview earlier today and I told someone, when I think back over my life, I think it really started from childhood. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about the work I do. So you mentioned the fact that, you know, I started my life from birth until almost 4 years old through in the foster care system in New York. And I was actually raised for those years by a white foster family. And I think a lot of who I am as a person, because you think about it as a parent, those first 4 years, 4 or 5 years even, or the very formative years of a child. And so I feel like I still have and carry a lot of my, especially my foster mom, because I remember her fondly, with me in terms of who I am. And I remember just kind of growing up and oftentimes I would be the only person who looked like me in a class because I was in advanced classes, or I was the only person who looked like me on a team because the team wasn't very diverse. Or when I got into leadership positions, I was the only person who looked like me that was a leader sitting around the table with the C-suite. And I'm like, no one else here looks like me. No one else here thinks like me. You know, do I really belong here? Those types of things. And then I've also experienced, you know, inequity and unfairness and discrimination and, you know, being underrepresented, of course, experiencing disadvantage as well. And I think that's what drives the work that I do. So I started my career in HR over 30 years ago as an administrative assistant. And I had a mentor who really poured into me, really believed in me, saw something in me I didn't see in myself. And I think that also helped spark me to think I could probably make a career out of this. And I just really went down that path, you know, from a very early age. And now, you know, fast forward 30 plus years later, I was more interested in the diversity space back in 2007 when the first millennial started entering the workforce. Because I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm a woman of a certain age.
Yeah, I am too. So welcome to the club.
Exactly. But I remember, you know, as a recruiter and going onto campuses, I was thinking this group is different. Like the things they're asking for and the questions that they're asking and their expectations of employers is completely different. And that kind of tipped my toe into understanding how to diversify the workforce through age. And then over years, I started focusing on women in leadership. And then women of color in leadership. And now we're really having the conversations that I wanted to have back in 2007 when I first got interested in diversity work. And so, you know, doing that type of work and being focused in the different areas and now, you know, having these courageous conversations that we're having now in the workplace, to me, is just very fulfilling. And it's really, you know, the work that I feel needed to be done all those years before, you know, even though we don't want to ignore age bias. We don't want to ignore gender bias. As you said, those are all important, or even disability, whether physical or neuro or, you know, invisible in some way, or LGBTQ plus as well. So all of those things are important. And so now I get to look at it through all of those lenses in the work that I do, which is really phenomenal because, again, organizations are really having these moments of reckoning in ways that they hadn't before.
Right, right. And I was, you know, curious about that, like for you in the field that you're doing and like, you know, how some of these conversations are actually beginning to play out. I mean, we don't need to recreate 2020, but 2020 really was this catalyst, you know, and in a lot of ways. And of course, we've had a few in history, but they, you know, it's like, we had another one, right? And we're here, but there's this enlightenment that came with it. Like it happened in a generation where the millennials are not kids anymore. They're like in their 30s, right? So they're now, you know, maturing. And I've had some comments. Yeah, I know, right? Like they're just now turning 40. Yep. And you know, and Gen X is, you know, I think we've all gone through some midlife crises a little earlier than the boomers did. So we started to figure out like we've been neglected and now I'm suffering from that. And what am I going to do? So I think there's all those, also this mental space that actually made it receptive to some degree to be able to kind of dig in and do some self-work and some self-look, you know, at it. You know, have you seen that? I mean, is that like, you know, maybe some of the differences between the environment of 2007 versus the environment of 2020 and 2021?
Yeah, I think for 2020, we were primed and ready. So when you think about what we were facing just globally around a pandemic, so we were all home for the first time around the world with very few interruptions, right? We didn't have sports, we didn't have entertainment, we didn't have activities outside the home. And everyone was seeing George Floyd get murdered right in front of their eyes together. And there was no denying it. And there was no saying, oh, I didn't see that story. Oh, I missed that, right? I didn't watch the news last night. Like there was no denying it. And so I think bringing that conversation into the workplace and seeing all of the protests that were going on. And yes, for the most part, it was Gen X and I mean, Gen Y and Gen Z that were out there. There were some others as well, my generation, boomers. But for the most part, Gen Y and Gen Z, the millennials and Gen Z were driving these conversations and they were like, enough is enough, zero tolerance. And the expectation is, that's what we're going to experience in the workplace, is zero tolerance, right? And so the conversations that started happening last summer, again, for the first time in my career, were enlightening. They were heartbreaking. They were transparent, raw, authentic. And to have CEOs have to sit in that space and hear what the lived experiences were of their Black and Brown employees in particular was eye-opening for them. And to the point where they felt, we can't come back from this and be the same company. Like that would be such harm to these employees. And that's not the type of organization that we need to have. So, you know, I can tell you the CEOs that I've worked with and continue to work with, you know, they were all in and they still are. So there's, you know, a year plus later, they're still doing the work. They're still transforming their culture, you know, through the lens of inclusion and belonging for all employees. And I say bravo to them. My concern is that, you know, as time goes on, of course, the next hashtag comes out, or the next big movement, whatever that may be, that this may get pushed further and further and further away from the agenda. And my goal is to, the companies I work with, is to make certain that it stays front and center, just like all of the other work that they're doing, all of the other strategic goals that they have for the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my favorite books is Doing Democracy by Bill Moyer. And it was something that I came across in getting my master's degree. And it talks about, you know, how you create, you know, how social change is usually created. And there's like these steps that go along. And, you know, in 2020 definitely was, and the murder of George Floyd was the, like a catalyst, you know, again, it was kind of like another catalyzation. But like you said, there was a perfect storm going on that this high level of consciousness was raised about it. A lot of questions being asked. But what happens after in social movements, as Bill Moyer, when he was studying all of these, is there is this letdown, which appears like it's losing ground again. Like, oh, all the energy is all high, and now we all just are back to the status quo. But if there's been a good effectiveness in like creating that change, while it looks like there's a letdown, there's a lot of people actually working on it. And then it'll start to really, you know, kind of take root, because you have to have the public actually just pissed off enough to actually want something to happen, right? Like leaders can talk about it. Politicians can talk about it, but policies and social justice never really changes until you've got a groundswell of the public that says now's enough. And that pushes upwards and onto the system. And maybe the energy level of the public goes down, but now you've got so much force and pressure up here that you can't go back. Like everything's starting to shake apart and restructure in there. You know, and I think that that's something that I want to believe that that's actually what we see right now, but I haven't seen like a letdown as much of intensity. I mean, obviously, you know, last summer was, I mean, it was just rife with energy, you know, a lot of it out there. And obviously that's not what's happening now, but I think the conversations seem to still be pushing on and pushing forward. forward, you know? Is that just my own like naive look at this, or do you see that in your role in the work that you're doing?
I see both, honestly, to be honest with you. And I think, you know, again, I'll speak to the companies that I work with, because they're companies that I started working with and I fired them because they didn't have the sustainability to keep this going. For the companies that I do work with, I also help them manage their employees' expectations around the work that they're doing, to understand that things won't happen overnight. It took us a long time to get here. There's resources such as people, time, and budget that need to be allocated or reallocated. And oh, by the way, we still have to do our jobs, right? We still have day jobs. So it's a matter of helping the employees come along on that journey with the organizations to understand that your experience in the workplace may not immediately feel different, but just know that there is work being done behind the scenes. Some of it you may hear or feel immediately. Some you may not hear or feel for 6 months, 12 months down the road. Like immediately people wanted to see more Black people in leadership. I'm like, well, what we're not going to do is fire people for this. So let's wrap our heads around that and understand that what that means is we need to look internally, find out who our high performers are. If there's a lack of diversity there, find out why, because there's bias involved in that, in those decisions. And then let's build our own future leaders, emerging leaders internally first. So that way, when a seat does open, we don't have to go outside and look for someone. We don't have to go in our own network because 90% of them look like us, and we're probably going to pull in someone who looks like us. We look internally. We've already started to prime the pump for our own internal talent, and we can pull someone who's diverse, whatever that means, into that next position. So that's the work that we're doing internally. And that's the understanding I'm helping them, you know, really share with their employees to understand, like, although everyone around the leadership table may look the same right now, and although no one may be leaving here, as far as we know, within the next 3, 5, 10 years down the road, that doesn't mean that we aren't priming the pump for our next level of managers, and just helping them understand that, and helping them understand what does it take to get into the program and who is a high performer? How do we define that? Making certain that the managers that are over that those employees, that they don't have their own level of bias and favoritism or nepotism about who they think should be in that group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you talked about, like, you know, not firing people, you know, one of my other guests is a scholar, and she does, she works out of Chicago, and we talked about the patriarchy and the patriarchal system. And, you know, I'm in the mental health field, in the trauma field, right? You know, my awareness is on triggers, you know, and you know, my personal triggers, but also my experiences in working in entrepreneurship and in business, and how things become triggering. And when we talk about bias, and accusation, that we all have biases, and this, you know, some people get really defensive and triggered by it, and leaders can particularly become super triggered because, you know, we don't want to admit that there may be some, you know, something wrong with us as leaders.
Or say, you're not a racist.
Right. I'm not racist. You know, yeah, absolutely. Right. Like 100%. And so how do you end up tackling that? Like, I asked her that question, like, how can you have conversations when we talk about biases around, and accusations? Like, I'm going to air quote accusations, but when you say, listen, have you noticed that everybody looks the same here? And somebody's thinking, I didn't mean for that to happen, but they feel accused now that they did do something wrong. And, you know, we tend to defend ourselves, right? Like, we go back to that, I didn't mean it, or whatever, or we deny that it was happening, or, you know, any of those other challenges. So how do you work through that with, you know, a board, a table of, you know, all white men, to talk about diversity, and that every, you know, no one's getting fired here, but, you know, they need to get serious about it, right?
Yeah. Those are the conversations I have probably on a weekly basis.
And I'm sure you get paid well to have those conversations, or I hope you do.
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost, I try to create as safe of a space as I can for them, so that they can lower their guard and their defenses. Because if they're not willing to, A, be called in, I'm not going to say called out, if they're not willing to be called into those conversations to understand what their own bias may have been in some of those decisions around who they selected for their leadership team, then it's going to start off being an uphill battle. And then giving them that self-awareness to say, okay, I understand where those blind spots were for me. Now, for some, it may happen very quickly. For others, it may take multiple conversations to get them there. And what I found is that most of them, at least the CEOs that I'm currently working with and the executive team members that surround them, are, again, aware of how it happened, right? And it wasn't intentional. As you said, they weren't being bad people at the time. They thought, of course, they picked the most qualified person, which is what I always encourage people to do. But what they didn't do was diversify the pool that they pulled that talent from. So that was the first linchpin for them in terms of making certain that everyone didn't look like them. They went through their network, friends, you know, their buddies from school. You know, they tapped the shoulder of someone who knew someone that looked like them and not even thinking like, oh yeah, he or she's a great person, bring them in, right? And they also didn't look internally deep enough within the organization. So now I think you know, having them come to that realization and having them feel safe to say, I'm not telling you to fire anyone here. That's not my job to do. I mean, at some point, if you do a performance process and you find out the person's not qualified or they're not doing a good job, that's an internal decision. That's not for me to come in and tell you. Also, if they feel that the entire team that's sitting around their table is not bought into this journey with them, and I've told them that, you may see some attrition happen as a result of that, which is healthy for the organization, and it probably mm-hmm. should happen. And that means a seat or two may open. So that's how I create those opportunities for them to have that level of self-awareness, to have those candid conversations. And I meet with the CEOs privately first before in front of their team, because I want to get to know who they are and kind of how they got to be who they are and make the decisions that they make. And I have to build that rapport with them. So even if someone from HR reaches out to me first to say, hey, we want to bring you in for this consulting opportunity or this training opportunity, the first thing I ask is, where's your CEO? I need to talk to him or her or them to understand kind of what their thought is around this work and how bought in are they in this work as well.
Yeah. No, huge challenge there, right? And sometimes the human resources team sees the pain and feels the pain on a daily basis because they're handling the employee complaints or the issues, you know, and they want to solve the problem. But, you know, a CEO that doesn't buy in or is performative, you know, in the process, it totally undermines the abilities to be able to do anything meaningful and whatnot, which is unfortunate. Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that I noticed, we were just talking about leaders. We took a little pause for anybody, but it won't be all, I'll clip that all out of her running to get her Instacart, but we're back here again. And one of the things, you know, about leadership and whatnot is, you know, I know you work with this as well, which is companies really become very concerned about culture, right? And we can have our personal culture, like our friends we hang out with and the things that we do. And then businesses develop culture sometimes spontaneously, and it may not be the culture they want. It just kind of evolves based on, you know, what's been going on in the company. But when companies set off to design a culture of intention and it's integrated into their hiring practices and their assessment and their leadership practices, bias seems like it can get mixed in there and kind of interfere with that. Right. I mean, I can see like when we're talking about affinity and familiarity, and then we and our culture becomes the familiar standard that we're doing, that we can lean too heavily into those biases. So how do you separate the bias from building a culture and having that culture still remain inclusive and diverse? Does that make sense?
It does. And it is a journey and it's never ending. So because at the end of the day, we're dealing with human beings and we are complex people, but also very, very simple at the same time. And so you will have instances where maybe there would be pockets of bias, let's say a particular manager, and you happen to notice that this manager, his team looks very homogenous, his or her, or their team looks very homogenous based on whatever that characteristic is. That's the point where either HR or talent acquisition or that manager's manager needs to call them in to find out why that is. Like, why did you make that last hiring decision? Did you look around your team and see whose voice is missing? Have you considered other candidates? Where are you looking for candidates from? And if they're relying, let's say, on the recruiters or talent acquisition to bring people into for them to interview, and they notice that everyone pretty much looks the same, then they should challenge that with recruiting, because maybe the bias is on the front end in recruiting. So yeah, to your point, you can foster the culture based on your values, your mission statement, you know, what you want to be famous for and all of those good things. But at the end of the day, you know, the culture is the people. But they do say, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast, as Peter Drucker says. Mm-hmm. And that's true, because you can have a great strategy, but if your culture is horrible or toxic or it's not inclusive, then you're not going to be able to accomplish that strategy because you won't have the team to do it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's something that you know, working with companies on that as well is like, you know, if your people aren't in, and one of the things that, you know, when we talk about, again, the biases, and again, you know, we're working at it with gender, some of these biases and stereotypes hurt everybody in there. You know, the bias that can interfere with our levels of confidence or entitlement or our contributions, right? And when we carry those, then we may be getting marginal performance out of people around us. And when we're able to recognize what those limitations look like and some assumptions we may have made about people that we work with or are bringing in, and get those out of our way, you know, everything gets elevated. We thrive, you know, we're happier, you know, where we're at when we get to be our whole selves, and not worry about, you know, having to change or adapt or adjust, you know, to fit into the norm. And I've worked in the blue collar fields for like the first half of my career. So my adjustments were around, you know, definitely around the gender play of, you know, being in manufacturing, being in construction, having to listen to colleagues talk about, in fact, I had this conversation just a couple of weeks ago at a networking event. Somebody was talking about going and getting their MWBE certification, which is minority women business owned, you know, for people that aren't in the business. It's a certification that verifies that you are indeed either disadvantaged community, underrepresented minority, or a woman owned business. And I remember working with a company back in the day that had the certification because they gave the ownership to the wives, but those wives had nothing to do with the businesses. And all of these men had this just very strong feeling of it was all bravado, it was all cool, and really women couldn't do the job. They were just getting the certification. And then there's this low bar, you know, dialogue of, you know, complaining about diversity and inclusion because of what we're talking about here. Some bias in our head that there's lower quality out of this whole community for whatever the BS reason is that you've been taught into that underpins the decisions that happen and the way we treat the people on our team. Like, you may end up hiring people of color, but that bias, if it gets in your way, it gets in the way of the promotions and the respect and the responsibility and the assignment of all of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of times when companies are looking at their demographics, they're shocked to realize that most of their Black, Indigenous people of color are in the lower rankings within their organization. Or they'll say, oh, we're really diverse. And then they look to see where that diversity lies. And they think, oh yeah, once we get past mid-level, it thins out, right? And we thin out with women, and we thin out with Black, Indigenous people of color, and we thin out with LGBTQ plus. So people just like, they realize like they've kind of started to keep them at the lower, you know, half of the organization without opportunities for promotion. And honestly, you know, I would think it goes back to even being systemic, right? So let's talk about Black people in particular. So the thought process for many years, I mean, we've been here since 1619, the thought process was that we weren't as intelligent, we weren't as talented, we weren't as qualified. And that's carried through the Jim Crow era, that's carried through the Civil Rights era, that's carried through the 70s, the 80s, 90s, and now the millennium. And that's something that I think people still have embedded in their belief system is that, oh, well, they're not as qualified. Or if you think diversity, yeah, we have to lower our standards, or we have to change our job description so we can get more qualified people of color in because we have to lower the qualifications in order for them to qualify. I'm like, no, that's not true. You're just looking in the wrong place. You know, and the CEO of Wells Fargo got into big, big trouble for saying something very similar last year on a town hall where he said, well, the reason why we don't have more, you know, minorities or diverse talent within our leadership rankings is because we just can't find them. What? Yeah, the backtrack said, I realized that was my own bias. I was very, very wrong. And we're going to diversify where we look for talent. And also we're going to look internally because I know we have some very talented Black, Indigenous people of color right here in Wells Fargo, which they do, but they didn't look at it for promotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a great example. And I saw this too. And I mentioned this kind of got a lot of hackles up on my Facebook post when I did this, but I was talking about, again, salary comparisons in the WNBA and after Sue Bird compared to LeBron James, and the conversation in the thread. And I mentioned this on the other episode about the patriarchy as well, was, you know, well, you know, people just don't like watching women's sports. That's why men make more money, because people prefer that. And I kept saying, are you sure that you just haven't been told that that's what you should believe about women's sports, is that, you know, women's basketball just isn't as exciting. And, you know, and all the defensive of it. And that is, you know, and of course it's hard to start to not get a little bit, feisty. I get feisty, about it and challenging, and then people get triggered on it. But when we talk about, again, this bias, that's also a way bias shows up. Like your example there, the Wells Fargo, and, you know, the example of, well, but people believe this.
Right.
sometimes the belief is the bias that right. It's not, it's been ground into us that that's the belief we should carry. Right.
Yeah. The NCAA had the same issue with the female basketball players versus the male basketball players at March Madness, and with them not giving them the proper equipment for working out. Remember that story?
Yep.
Now, you know, not quite a year later, they are investing all this money in them. They're making certain that they're on the posters for March Madness and that they're in front of the right advertisers, because they realize like they earn just as much attendance as the male basketball team. So yeah, that was their own bias embedded within that system. And that's why I said a lot of times it is systemic.
Mm-hmm, right. You know, one of the interviews that I saw you did, you talked about the importance of having a DEI consultant come in with companies to be able to help them with this. And I want to be able to say how much I support that idea, because I think that we all saw, like, I'm on LinkedIn. LinkedIn's probably where I'm more active in terms of social media. And of course, on LinkedIn, there's the performative parts of DEI, which is find a Black person in my company and give them the role, right? You know, and a lot of people going, whoa, that's not always the right answer. And also, come on, you got to pay somebody to do this, right? Like, don't just give them the role and not give them any extra salary for all the extra work on that on top of their job. Right. But one of the things that I feel like, you know, I had a conversation with a woman a couple of weeks ago, and she wanted to bring race into this conversation, you know, because obviously from people watching the video, I am a white cisgendered woman. So I have my filter of life. And it's hard. It's hard, especially if you aren't trained to hold space and to be able to talk about it like you talked about. You have to be able to set psychological safety for this. And if we haven't really received some extra training and to be able to do that, I really do believe that it can backfire to some extent. Like, you could end up hurting and injuring people that you don't mean to be able to do that, right?
Yes. And that has happened. You know, there were tons of examples of that. Again, thinking back to last June, July, when the organizations decided they wanted to have these listening sessions and town halls and hear from their employees. And you heard about places like Google, for instance, where it backfired because they didn't have a professional. They decided they were going to use internal resources. And then all of these comments questions came up that they weren't prepared to handle, that turned it into a toxic experience for the individuals that were already, you know, sharing their raw feelings in terms of what their lived experiences were like in the workplace, outside of the workplace, as people of color. And, you know, they didn't invest. And as you said, creating that psychologically safe space, bringing in an expert. And I don't agree with them, you know, picking or tapping the first most senior level Black person on the shoulder and say, hey, you're now responsible for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Because just because they're Black doesn't mean they're qualified either. So it is about making certain that the person who's doing the work is experienced in it, that they know how to come in without their own personal agenda on the table or leading the conversation from that perspective. That they are able to talk to the middle of the room. So that way they're not trying to bring all of the people that are so far to the left, bring them along. That's a lot of energy and effort, and some of them will never come along, and that's okay. And just know how to navigate those conversations and discussions in a way that leads for people to feel that they are safe and that they can share openly without retribution, without retaliation, that they will be respected both during and after those conversations or after sharing their experiences. And that's not an easy thing to do.
No. Especially when you think about, like, when we sit back and we reckon, you know, where the biases are in ourselves, and we can be honest with that. There's a lot of vulnerability when you open your mouth to share that. And that's the other thing I think about is, you know, for some people to be vulnerable to say, yeah, I will admit that I have done, said, and behaved in this way. I meant no harm. But if someone's been injured by those actions, it's hard sometimes to give that grace, you know, to be able to allow it. And that can get out of control. And I think that, you know, we see that on social media, you know, I mean, that's like the biggest shit show, right? Of all of it. And oftentimes what we're seeing is all of our biases coming into the mix and us oversimplifying all of this and then trying to argue with someone's perspective, but bias is rooted in there. Like, you know, I mean, it does kind of get in the way of us being able to see consciously and rationally about things. But vulnerability is so important in this. And some people can be vulnerable, but some people can't protect the vulnerability in other people and give them the ability, especially if your own vulnerability has been triggered or traumatized. And if you have been, again, like I go back to and say this, like if you have been a victim of this behavior, maybe not from this person who just expressed this with you that they've done it, but from somebody else, it's, we're human beings. It's, we're going to feel that injury all over again. I mean, that's going to happen, but we have to be able to, you know, have some sense of, I don't want to say control because we can never control that, but you know what I mean? Like we have to be able to have an ability. And if we can't do that, somebody in the room's got to be able to be the shepherd in the room to be able to keep all of that so that everybody can leave, like you said, and, you know, kind of go on and not lose respect for each other or whatever. Cause I imagine respect goes out the window really fast if somebody, you know, admits like, yeah, I used to think that about this. I never promoted Black people cause I always thought they were blah, 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 you know, racist prejudice you want to throw in right there. But now I know somebody that was hurt by that might have a hard time letting that go, you know?
Yeah, no, true. And, you know, I have one CEO in particular, it took him probably, oh gosh, I would say 6 months to host this type of listening session for his company. His company is just about 200 employees. It's not huge. And his concern was that exact thing, right? He's like, at the end of the day, you know, I consider us a family. I want us to be able to get along after this is over. I mean, he was so, so very worried about this could go so far to the left and there'd be no recovery and people will feel damaged and hurt and betrayed. And, you know, I don't want that to happen. And so we were able to navigate the conversation very successfully. And even to his surprise, and I said, look, I said, if this goes wrong, I'll give you the money back. Like, that's how certain I am that I can navigate this conversation in a way that will be safe and secure and you know, create a space where people won't feel threatened. And that's exactly what happened. And so that's why I said it's so important to have the right person doing this kind of work, because it isn't just about, you know, where are we recruiting from and how do we hire the next Black leader? It goes so far beyond that. And then when you think about diversity, it crosses so many different social categories. And then when we think about intersectionality, then we have the cross sections of social categories that we have to consider as well. Like I'm a female, cisgender female. I may be part of a minority on a team. I mean, a majority on the team, but when you add in my race of Black, now I may become a minority. So because I'm a Black cisgender woman and now I'm over 50, add that in, I may be even a greater minority as a result of that. So we have to think about all aspects of that when we are designing strategy and thinking about how to shift the culture and create a place of inclusion and belonging for all employees. Like I go in this thinking about every single employee that's there. I don't have a specific group that I'm focused on, even if the demographics are very, very low for them. At the end of the day, yes, I would like to see those numbers go up. It's going to take time. But at the end of the day, what we have to work on in terms of a culture is making sure that all employees feel that there are no barriers to their success, that they can achieve the highest level of opportunities here, that they are welcome, that they don't have to code switch to assimilate, that they can be their true authentic selves, because to your point, they'll be more productive, more engaged, more motivated, and ultimately more loyal to the organization. And oh, by the way, you might even get them to stay a little longer than a couple of years these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, all good points. So amazing. Oh my gosh. Well, in addition to being a consultant and doing all this amazing stuff with companies, you're also an author. And so I want you to talk about the book that I saw that you have, like it's available because, and why, you know, this needs to get into the hands of everybody that's listening right now.
Sure. Thank you. So yeah, this is my fourth book and I'm really excited about it. It's my biggest project to date. It's called Working While Black, A Woman's Guide to Stop Being the Best Kept Secret. And I was able for the first time to share what my journey was like throughout corporate America through the lens of a Black woman. And I was able to also bring in the voices of, I think it was 8 other Black women, including Swati Mandela, who was the granddaughter of Nelson and Winnie Mandela. To share her story, because I wanted to get a global perspective to say, okay, this is what the experience is like for Black women in America. What was it like in other countries? And so she was able to and willing to share her story as well. And within those stories, we also share strategies for what do we do in order to help us learn how to own our power, our truth, our healing, our worth, and ultimately our destiny as ultimately as women in the workplace. And so I tell people, although the title says, Working While Black, there are strategies in there that every single person could probably use in the workplace. But it's also good for those who aren't Black to read those stories and understand what some of the challenges that, you know, each of us face. There are some common threads there and some things that are unique to each person. And as allies, how can you now use that information to really further the cause for people that may look like us that are in your workplace?
Yeah, 100%. I have a book too, The Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business, and it talks about the gender. And I say the same things that you say, that, like, you know, this whole conversation between you and I is about these underlying belief systems that we don't know are there. And the one of the biggest ways that we get to combat them, be aware when they happen and actually do something about it, is to seek out information about what the other experiences are like and to actually put ourselves in those shoes and see what they are. And, you know, and I will, you know, when men have asked me about my book, it's like, if you want to know what it's like to be a woman in entrepreneurship and all the grooming we got that gets in our way of being successful in business, and what the social studies tell us about gender in the workplace, as well as the psychology, that's why you read the book, not because you actually are a woman starting a business. And with yours is like, again, that intersection of even more into it to, you know, to get it, because women of color, I mean, we talk about women in the, you know, the issues and the systemic hurdles, but women of color then have a whole nother quarter mile of hurdles even after that. Like, we just passed equal pay day for women of color in August when the women's was like back in February. So women of color, for everybody listening, if you don't know this, have to work like, what is it now, 18 months longer than a white man to earn the same salary for the same amount of work. 18 months to get what a white man will earn in a 12-month period. Like, that's what that means. And that is like, that's not equal. That's not justice. Yep. And that's why we're talking about, like, how do we become aware of what's going on in the world and in ourselves? Because humans create the systems we live in. So if we want to break systems, we have to start to understand how to dismantle some of these things that are getting in our own ways. And so thank you for, like, having the conversation with me and hopefully enlightening a few people throughout all this. I really appreciate it.
I did too. And I forgot to mention that the book is available for pre-order on both Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or on my website at TanaMSession.com.
Absolutely. And I'll have links to that in the podcast notes so everybody can actually click the little link button in this when you open up your podcast app and be able to pre-order that copy and do so. Tana, thank you so much. Again, for those of you, you're listening to this probably on a Sunday or whatever day, but we're having an interview at the end of the day, and we've got to get on with our life. So thank you so much for all your time.
It was a great interview.
Oh, awesome. Cool.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiaquercone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.